Blankets. If you go outside, you won't need them. Okay, our final presenter is Judge Mark Goodner, who is now judge in Wood Creek. He is also our program attorney and deputy counsel. And Mark is going to talk to us about ethics and the new media. And I don't know about you guys, but this is something that I really need to pay attention to, because that new media, I'm not getting there. Let's give Mark a welcome.
Thank you very much. Okay, so you all can see the light at the end of the tunnel. We got just over an hour left, and I'll try to give you a couple minutes back before noon. A couple things I want to remind you of. First of all, Jameson's walking around with your certificate of attendance. You can turn that in with all of your evaluation forms. That's what certifies that you are here for all of your required judicial training for the year. So you need to make sure you sign that. Also, on the evaluation form, I think I'm the only speaker who's listed on the flip side. So you have to turn me over, and you'll see my name up at the top of the back, I believe. So that's where you will evaluate me. One other thing before I get rolling here. This is the TxDOT sign-in sheet for the cell phones and driving class, which did not make it around for the judges yesterday. So I'm going to start it around. If you were in the cell phones class with Kathy Riedel, where you watched all those heartbreaking videos of those kids that had passed because of these accidents, I'm going to send it around.
Just a statement. I've been to every class. I haven't seen the sign-in
yet. You would only get a sign-in sheet in a breakout dealing with traffic safety. So most of the classes, there wouldn't be one. But it's only those breakouts involving traffic safety. Okay, so I'm going to start it right here. We'll try to make sure it gets around to everyone so we can cash our TxDOT check that they agreed to fund our training. Okay, so housekeeping announcements. But for the next hour and 10 minutes or so, we're going to talk about technology and how that interacts with ethics in today's world. And technology is so great in so many ways, and it has increased and developed so quickly. It's made, in some ways, our lives much more efficient and much easier. But at the same time, it can make them more complex. And we have to try and apply these ethical rules, or the rules of professional responsibility, that really can only be updated every so often. You can get the powers of the be together to talk it over and decide on the language might happen every 10 years. It did not and could not have anticipated all of the wonderful, incredible technology that we have at our fingertips. So to kind of get us primed here for this discussion, I want you to work with me just for a second. Little anticipation exercise. I want you to think about, everybody close your eyes for a second. I know you're trying to scramble to finish your papers. Everybody close your eyes a second, and I want you to think back to a simpler time in your life. If you can think back 20 years ago, think back 20. If you can think back 30 or 40 or 50, even better. But think back to an earlier time before we had all of these technologies, you know, maybe before you had your cell phones and your microwaves and everything that we have now. Okay, now that you should be back in your mind to a simpler place, go ahead and open your eyes, and this is what I want you to do. I'm going to give you about 2 minutes to talk with your neighbor, and I want you to come up with the greatest single technological advancement or achievement that changed the way that you live your life. And we're going to do it by decade, so this is how we'll do it. Inside, I want you to come up with the biggest change in the 70s, and the 90s, and this side, you all do the 80s and 2000s, okay? 70s and 90s, 80s and 2000s. So from those respective decades, come up with the biggest technological change that changed the way that you live your life, whether that might be entertainment, communication, or whatever. But take a couple minutes to do that. Some of you may be saying, I'm so young, I don't remember the 70s, but do your best. Sitting in the back, she's the only one that can give you approval for that, okay? Okay, I hear some good discussion going on. Take just about 30 more seconds to come up with your final answers, and we'll talk about it. Okay, sounds like discussion has died down. So over here, somebody gave me a big change from the 70s. Just go ahead and call it out. Put it up here. Microwave, okay. 1970s, anything else? TV remote, okay. Hey, that may change the way life, big time for a lot of us. Anything else? Okay, computers. And when we talk about the 70s, we're probably not talking about computers like we think today. Not a home PC, but those supercomputers of the 70s that took up an entire building and came together and were really excited because they have this new supercomputing machine that could calculate, you know, complete 100 calculations a minute, and it had 8 bytes of memory. And that sounds ridiculous because we care about things that are exponentially more powerful and capable. Anything else in the 70s? Think about entertainment. Anything come along, change? Okay, or maybe, yeah. Or the betas? Betamax? Okay, Atari? That's probably right around, I would think, 1980, but maybe 70s Atari. So video games started coming around then. Early ones like Pong. Anything else in the 1970s? How'd you listen to music in the 1970s? Any changes about that? Okay. Tracks or maybe cassettes started coming in. Anything else in the 70s? All right, 80s. Big changes. Anything? Okay, 80s, early cell phones, and again, we're not talking about the cell phones we see today, probably those ones where you had to carry around a little suitcase and had a wire up to your ear. Digital pagers, yeah. I remember going to church when I was a little kid in the early 80s, and only a few people, you know, would have those pagers, doctors and lawyers being called out at an emergency. Anything else? So we have procedures. Satellite TV. And again, we're not talking about those 18-inch or dishes. We're talking about the ones that were 10 feet across, 8 feet across that you could take a bath in. Fax machine, okay. Anything else in the 80s you can think of? Pagers, okay. Okay, PCs. That's when really we started having the personal computers. Those early IBMs that worked on DOS, where you had to type in, you know, D:\run and things like that. And they had the disk that actually flopped. Anything else from the 80s? Internet? Well, that may have its roots in the 80s. Probably didn't hit the general public quite that early. But yeah, that's when we had governmental use of internet, I think, during the 80s. Anything else in the 80s? What started anything replacing cassette tapes and, okay, CDs? Laser discs? Okay, fast food changed the way you ate. Just like microwaves came around in the 70s, gone were the days of putting in those foil-wrapped TV dinners and waiting an hour and a half for your oven to cook it. All right, 90s. What do we see changes in the 1990s? Okay, internet becoming widespread and available still early on and personal use. That's on the probably the age of AOL and Prodigy using chat rooms. Okay, everything's better and faster, but a lot of the same types of things. Okay, vehicles changing. You heard about the evolution of traffic safety, more and more vehicles, more advancements there. Okay, portable PCs, laptops. Everybody in the house can have one. Widespread use of cell phone, right? We started seeing people have smaller, more portable cell phones. What about televisions? How'd they start changing in the 1990s? Seen them get smaller, seen them get bigger. Maybe started seeing the flat screen. The flat screens, not flat panels yet probably, but flat screens, HD. Anything else in the 90s? Okay, CDs. And then late 90s, what started replacing CDs probably late 90s, early 2000s? MP3 players, digital music. Okay, 2000s to now, last 10 or 11 years. Okay, social media. We talked about MP3, but really even more like iPods, you know, the Apple explosion, things like that. Anything else? Okay. Earbuds, being connected all the time, whether using that with your iPods or iPhones to not only music, but what maybe watching TV or movies that way. Bluetooth. Streaming video. Yeah, internet keeps continually changing. Okay. The death of print media, the beginning. Newspapers are going away. There's no longer the revenue from classified ads being replaced by things like Craigslist, free online postings, blogs taking over, electronic access. Things are having to change. Anything else? Electronic resources. Yeah, those of you that are in practicing law for a while probably saw a big change from, you know, going to the library versus using LexisNexis, Westlaw. Okay, good. So we have a huge list here over the last four decades that really changed the way that we lived. And so now, keeping in, and that's really what we're going to focus on, these types of technologies and how we can use those and maintain our ethics. So the goals of this next hour: identify the role of the judge and court personnel in promoting public confidence in the judicial system. And similar language we see all the time, promoting public confidence, maintaining, avoiding impropriety or the appearance of impropriety. When it comes down to judicial ethics and attorney ethics, a lot of times it's not necessarily what we're doing, but what people think we're doing, making sure that we have the right appearance. We'll discuss traps for the unwary with examples. I'll have a lot of examples about where people use these technologies problematically, ethically, with some issues, and some of them you'll shake your head and say, wow, that person's a real idiot. And some of you will say, I can see how it would be really easy to do that. But this class is not about scaring you away from using technology. We'll end with some strategies for using these things ethically. How many of you have been a judge in here for more than 20 years? Okay, so those of you that have seen a transition in courts from a paper file system using filing cabinets moved more to an electronic system have probably seen a drastic change in the way that courts work. That might be e-filing or electronic ticket writers. How many of you have electronic ticket writers in your jurisdictions? Okay. And those of you, after you get over that initial hump of implementation and working the bugs out, has that increased accuracy and efficiency for the most part, would you say? Okay. At least you can read them, yeah. You know, you don't have to worry about if it's printed big. Yeah, we used to always hear about issues where an officer can't read their handwriting, or they, instead of writing Honda, they'd write Hyundai, or, you know, misspell something. Well, now if you can choose off of a list of choices, it can eliminate a lot of those issues. Court websites, video magistrations and hearings. Now, if you want to avoid a trip to the jail for magistration or a commitment hearing on a capious profine, you can do that from the comfort of your own home with internet connection with video and audio feed. And that's specifically allowed from the legislature. Courthouse security has changed. How many of you have walk-through metal detectors? Anybody have those? How many people have a wand? Bulletproof glass? Anywhere? Panic buttons? Okay. These are all things that you could use your security funds for. That would probably be a good idea. And, of course, case management software can really help move things along. Everything's built in. We'll generate the paperwork, figure out court costs, things like that. But what we're going to focus on today is personal technology, a lot of the things we're talking about up here on these pages. And when I say personal technology, personal communicative technology, the things that we use to communicate with others. And things have changed. 20 years ago, if you had a bad day at work, somebody was nasty to you or whatever, real angry leaving, You might blow off steam, you mumble under your breath on the way to your car, maybe you kick your tire, drive home angrily, tell your husband or wife about it, and then it can kind of dissipate and go away. And we need that some way to let off the steam. Well, the mumbling under the breath, now it's very easy for that to be replaced by a quick tweet, a status update on your Facebook, and instead of something being mumbled under your breath and going away without having an audience, now people are tempted to communicate with their friends and their network electronically, and they're creating this permanent digital record that could be floating around forever. So you can anticipate what some of the problems might be ethically that can really affect the public's perception of you. So we'll cast a real wide net during this class. I know that some of you are very wired and connected and might be tweeting right now. Some of you may not have a computer at home, may not have an internet, may not have an email address. So we'll talk about technologies and go over some things quickly here. What's this on the screen? How many iPhone people we have in here? Any Verizon people excited because you're about to get an iPhone? Okay. All right. So iPhone is much more than a phone, of course. You're really walking around with a high-powered computer. It's your entertainment center. It is your phone. It's your internet. It is any one of hundreds of thousands of applications that can help you live your life better and more efficiently. And then how many people do we have that are BlackBerry people? Any BlackBerry people? BlackBerry, still a big player in the smartphone market. Initially, its target audience was the business class. And the selling point of that, everything, all of your different email accounts can be pushed right to your phone immediately, and you can communicate from that one central location. And then laptops have increased the ability for us to be productive and conduct our business really from anywhere. Facebook, how many people do we have in here on Facebook? How many people here are on Facebook but you don't want to tell anybody in here that you're on Facebook? Okay, cat's out of the bag. So Facebook, yeah, that's you may have seen that the big movie this year, The Social Network, but Facebook is really, we're still very early on in this social media process. Came around in the 2000s, started out at Harvard University, limited just to Harvard. And then when I was in law school in the mid-2000s at UP, that's when I first heard about Facebook, and at that time it was limited to people with a college-based email address. So you knew at that time, 2005 probably when I first got on it, that anybody on there was either a student in college or a professor that had a college email address, or was a recent graduate. So that's who you knew you were talking to. Well, then sometime in 06 or 07, it became available to anybody with an email address. And that's when you saw things really change with Facebook, and it exploded. At that point, now you have all teenagers jumping on and people of all age groups jumping onto that. Twitter has exploded, and it's got some Texas roots. If you look at that, really gained notoriety in Austin at the South by Southwest Technology and Music and Film Festival. That's really kind of what put it on the map. Twitter, I am on Twitter, but I don't really use it. But basically, it's a micro blog. Okay, anybody that's following you can see your updates of up to 140 characters. And I'll show you a screenshot of it in just a second. MySpace.com is another social media platform that used to be, for a while, was bigger than Facebook, and then Facebook quickly overtook that. Facebook, I think, at least several months ago when I saw the numbers, had an 85% market share, and it's probably only grown since then. And the differentiation between Facebook and MySpace used to be Facebook, you knew somebody was in college or a professional, and MySpace, more likely to run into teenagers. Changed. Now everything's kind of moved to Facebook, but MySpace still has its following, and it's still used quite a bit in the music industry. Musicians, bands have MySpace pages. They can have all their music on there. So still used there. Who can tell me what this icon is right here? B. Okay. What's it stand for? Anybody know what that orange, strange-looking B? That's an icon, a blogger icon, a blog icon, which is short for weblog, which is an online diary, but it can be used in hundreds of different ways. You can get a free blog set up in just moments, and it's a way that you can connect with people. It's also used a lot now. It's starting to replace print media. We have journalists that are journalists because they maintain a blog. So those are some technologies out there. Those of you that are not on Facebook and have never seen it, here's a screenshot from my Facebook page back in October. So if you are curious to see what it looks like, this is what it looks like. In the center that kind of dominates your screen, you have the news feed. So you get updates from all of your friends. My friend Jorge changed employers, so he added a new employer. My cousin Sasha commented on a photo that she was in. A friend of mine from law school has a status update telling about her kid getting in trouble with the principal in junior high. So that's kind of what you see as it pops up. Up in the top left-hand corners, you get notifications. Right there, there's a little globe with a number 1 on it. That tells me I've got a notification. Somebody's commented on a post of mine or tagged a picture of me, something like that. Next to that would be a notification if somebody sent me a message, like an email-type message. Next to that, if somebody wanted to be my friend, a friend request. So that's what Facebook looks like. Twitter, this is Twitter. It's kind of like just the status feed of the Facebook, the center part. And not changes necessarily like people's employers. This is what people put in there, 140 characters or maybe a picture. So you can see this is from several months ago. I was following 15 people. I had 22 followers, but I had never tweeted one time. So anybody that was expecting anything from me would have been disappointed. Blog, this is an example of a Texas blog dealing with criminal justice. October 26th, entry, did the court illegally order the state to pay Sharon Keller's legal bills? Generally how this works is the latest blog entry is posted on the front page and everything else gets pushed down. And you can go back through archives and read all the articles. You can get updates through an RSS feed. So it's a complex world. All of these things are social platforms. Many of these things we talked about, blogging, microblogging, real simple syndication feeds that you might subscribe to if you're a follower of Fox News or MSNBC or CNN. You can subscribe to, or ESPN, RSS feed, and you'll be fed new stories. Widgets, social networking, chat rooms, message boards, podcasts, video sharing, photo sharing. A lot of these that used to be kind of separate entities are really combining. Everything's kind of becoming one in Facebook and YouTube. So all of those things. Yes? A widget? A widget is like a contained program that sits on the desktop of your computer. It's really more of an Apple term. So it's something that you don't have to open up a file within your computer to get to it. It sits right there. It's really quick access. Like if you might have something sitting on the desktop that shows you stock market prices or weather or things like that. So it's kind of a controlled small application that's readily available. We're going to see a video here, and I'll read some stuff if I think you can't hear it, and if the music is not your taste, I apologize. This was really designed for the business crowd, but the numbers and the statistics I think are unbelievable. So look at some of these statistics about social media. At the very beginning, it asks, is social media a fad, or is it the biggest shift since the Industrial Revolution? Pretty big statement, but let's look at some of these numbers here. Okay, any reactions to some of those numbers? First time I saw that, I just thought it was amazing and staggering. Some things to hit that I think are especially powerful. It took radio 38 years to hit 50 million users, and Facebook hit 200 million in less than a year. So that's how quickly things are growing. The other thing that was interesting, it said at one point, if Facebook were a country, it would be the third largest in the world. And then the next slide said, yet QQ and RenRen dominate China. Well, QQ and RenRen are social media platforms in Asia. So keeping in mind that dominates over there and taking off that huge population of China and countries around there, Facebook is still the third largest. So it's an enormous, social media in general is huge, and Facebook is the biggest player. We do have Facebook site and Twitter account through TMCEC. That's a great place. If you haven't liked the center on Facebook or subscribed to the TMCEC feed, it's a great thing to do. At least daily, there's something coming across telling you about new legislation, new developments, things like that. I would suggest that if you're using Facebook and Twitter, follow us there. So social networking, we saw that video. You can basically assume that they're being used all the time, everywhere, by everyone. Some statistics I found, The Economist, October 2009, British employees, 57% of staff use Twitter, Facebook, or other social networking websites for personal use during office hours, sometimes divulging sensitive business information. The average worker spends almost one working week a year on such sites. And you can imagine if that was just over a year old, year and a half old now, continued to. So if you are in a supervisory role, this is something you're going to have to anticipate, the use of these sites by employees. Whether that's something you can control or not, it's going to be a player in the game. And in some ways, social networking has replaced the coffee break, the water cooler talk. Instead of, you know, taking a break and talking to your coworkers at the water cooler about last night's big game or, you know, The Bachelor or whatever, now people can talk to anybody they want to in the world from their desk. So that's probably happening, you know, throughout the day. 86% of lawyers aged 25 to 35 use social networking, and 2/3 of lawyers over the age of 46. And again, that's over a year and a half old now. You can imagine the numbers continue to climb. So we always have to be aware of maintaining public confidence. We see that mentioned all over in the preambles to these rules in the Lawyer's Creed. It talks about maintaining public confidence. And it's a test, objective, not subjective, so we have to always be concerned with what the public thinks and not necessarily what is really happening. And there's even some articles now, is it ethical for an attorney not to be on social media and not to be using them? Are they being a zealous advocate if they don't have a presence there? There are some articles about that. Facebook is the number one source of research and divorce proceedings now. That's how parties look to see what's going on with, you know, the spouses, who they're communicating with, what they're up to. So it's used quite a bit. So we have all these great, wonderful technologies that we should use and take advantage of, but these ethical rules still apply. These rules that are only updated every so often, maybe every 10 years, had no idea that Facebook was coming down the pipe and that it was exploding. No idea all of the programs and technologies would become available. But we still have to follow the Code of Judicial Conduct, the disciplinary rules, ethics advisory opinions, statutes, court rules, and opinions. They're still out there. You heard from Judge Ramsey about the canons and about the commission. Many of these canons could be touched on and interact with your activity online and with technology. All of these, I think, looking at it very clearly, tie directly into technology. Probably the most important in my mind would be Canon 2, avoiding impropriety and the appearance of impropriety, and 2B, allowing a relationship to influence your decisions as a judge. Whether or not it's actually influencing, if you are the friend of somebody online, what's the perception there if that person is before court, so on and so forth. So it's a scary place. There are challenges out there, and now I'm going to get into some examples where people have messed up. First case, North Carolina child custody case. And those of us that are parents probably know that there may be no more emotionally charged situation than one involving your kids, your family. And if you ever have to go through any sort of child custody or divorce, you know how charged that can be and how difficult of a process that is. Well, during this case, the judge friended the lawyer on Facebook. Anybody have a problem right there with a judge friending a lawyer on Facebook at that point? Some people maybe, not necessarily. Well, what if I told you that was before them in court for this proceeding? Is there a problem now? What if the judge and the lawyer are commenting about the proceedings through Facebook as it's happening? Of course, you're starting to get to what? Ex parte communication, conversation with one party that the other party is not present for. Well, this is what was going on. The lawyer says, I have a wise judge. So you can imagine how you would feel as the mother in this hearing, and you see that your husband's attorney is buttering up the judge, and they're good friends online, and there's a conversation going on. Probably doesn't feel too good. The opposing lawyer, the lawyer representing the mother, discovered the friendship, asked for a new trial, and for the judge to be disqualified. The judge ultimately recused himself, and the wife got a new trial. Any work that was done up to that point was lost. The judge was also publicly reprimanded by the state for improper ex parte communications. So there's example number one. This guy's really interesting too, from New York, criminal court judge in Brooklyn. He was a real big social media guy. He was on Facebook, and he provided details of his location and schedule on Facebook. What's the concern there of giving your location and schedule on Facebook? Safety of you, safety of court personnel. Probably not a good idea to tweet and say, oh, got to the house early today, beat the officers here. Car's parked out back, you know, doors open, whatever. You know. You guys see a lot of people in your courts. Does everybody leave happy with you? So it's a concern. People are looking for a way to get back at you. And if you give them too much information, they might take advantage of it. He also updated his file and status while he was on the bench. He would post photos of his crowded courtroom on his Facebook. Can you imagine being in the middle of a proceeding and saying, get a picture of this, you know, clicks, okay, let me upload this to my Facebook. All right, continue on. Not the best appearance that you want to put out there about your judicial temperament. Judge also invited several lawyers to be his friend. We'll talk more about that. That might not be, probably is not a problem in itself, just that step. Ultimately, he was transferred to another court after supervisors learned of his online social networking activities. Okay, same judge was also not just on Facebook, but he was on MySpace. And one of the abilities on MySpace is to list your mood, your current mood. You can probably have a lot of appropriate moods that you would want the judge to have for appearing before. You know, maybe that would be thoughtful, calm. Probably what you would not expect is for your judge to say amorous. Okay, not necessarily the pinnacle of judicial temperament. You don't want. Might be weird to say let me check up on this judge I'm going before, and he's saying, hey, I'm looking for love and I'm ready. Come on into my court. MySpace. It also listed one lawyer among his friends. And that lawyer, gets worse, was a candidate for state assembly. There was a link to the attorney's campaign website where they could take money. And there were several postings promoting his candidacy. Well, we know we have some of these campaigning rules that specifically apply to us. So that was problematic there. Judge Bucky Wood in Georgia had to resign in December of 2009. He was a little overactive on Facebook. He was... allegedly had inappropriate contact with one. How do I make sure the justice is done? Them too much help, you know, because on their own. Well, this judge was clearly reportedly offered behind-the-scenes help in a criminal case. And then while he was flipping through their pictures, he started doing research and used a picture from her account to revoke a probation for some other defendant in the court. So the judge is like going on doing online research to see if they're following the orders. Very active there. Magistrate in England liked to tweet, and he was turned in by one of his fellow magistrates. On a Saturday morning, before magistrating those arrested on Friday night, this is what he said. Called into court today, was arrested last night and held in custody. I guess they will be mostly drunks, but you never know. Is there a perception there that there's a bias, that there's a decision that's already been made? I think so. Even if he has the statistics to back it up and say, hey, listen, every time I see somebody on Saturday morning, you know, 3 out of 4 are always there for intoxication. there's a perception that he's putting out there that the people that I'm going to see today are drunks. I've already made that decision. He also was kind of given a play-by-play about three cases, three men accused of robbery. This is the types of tweets he had. First defendant, conspiracy to rob Telford State Bank, I believe what it was called, of £500,000. Good start, wrong previous convictions presented. Finished hearing bail, three refused for planning robbery. Later he resigned when this all came to light. He tried to defend himself saying, well, listen, I didn't put these up there while I was on the bench. I was doing it in breaks in the retiring room. But that defense seemed to fall on deaf ears. Attorneys that are in the room, all of these disciplinary rules of professional conduct probably come into play with your online presence. We'll talk about some of these. We'll talk specifically about a case out of Texas involving 303, candor toward the tribunal. Online privacy law, email, client confidentiality is a concern. How can using email potentially endanger client confidentiality? Two ways. The first is unauthorized interception, and that's the person that's trying to intercept your email, hack into your stuff and get it for bad, you know, for the wrong purpose. Inadvertent misdirection of an email bearing confidential information is probably much more common. How many of you have ever started to write an email and you send it to, say, Jacqueline, and you start to send it to Jack? Do you want to send it to Jackson? Do you want to send it to this? It's very easy for the computer to try to do that guesswork, those autofill technologies, and it will guess. You know, two of our employees at the center, I've got Patty and I've got Pat. And when I put in PAT, it automatically tries to send it to Patty first because I email her more often. So you have to be careful about those types of things or you might be sending things to the wrong person. Just last week, I started getting all these emails from one of my professors in law school from 4 or 5 years ago talking about, I don't know if Mark has agreed to supervise this person for this internship. And obviously she was talking about another Mark because I had no idea what she was talking about. I thought she would figure it out, but then I kept getting the messages, so I sent her one and said, just so you know, I don't think you're talking to me. It's great to hear from you, but I don't know what you're talking about. She said, you're right. It was the person. So that's very easy to happen. Anybody sent that email? Send that to the right person? Did I copy that person inappropriately? You know, things like that. Here's the example about candor towards the tribunal. This happened in Galveston County in front of District Judge Susan Chris. I'll give you a little bit. It says here that the Judge Chris denied a lawyer's request for a continuance due to a death in the family. I'll give you a little bit more background. There was a death in the family, and the attorney asked Judge Chris, my father passed away. I need some time to grieve, to mourn. Can you move it back? Judge Chris said, absolutely. We'll move that back. I grant your continuance. So there was one continuance. And then the lawyer came back to ask for a second one. Said, but I'm still in a bad place. I need to continue grieving and mourning. Well, they happened to be Facebook friends, and Judge Chris was seeing during this time of supposed mourning and grieving, the lawyer is putting all these entries on there where she's bragging about her week of drinking and partying at the same time she was supposedly grieving. So she says, I'm grieving, and at the same time she's saying, oh, can't wait to go dirt biking again. I'm going to have mojitos tonight, things like that. These are some quotes in there. Now, I know we all grieve and mourn in different ways, but the judge decided, and I don't think you can find too much wrong with it. I think your grieving's done. Let's move on with this. So the lawyer clearly displayed a lack of candor towards the tribunal, maybe even some dishonesty. Christina and Peshek, on one hand, it's very sad, and on the other hand, it's completely appropriate. Assistant public defender in Illinois for 19 years. Okay, so public servant in a lot of ways, but she was fired and brought up on attorney discipline charges. She allegedly was revealing client confidences in blog posts. This is how it happened. She would identify clients by either their first name or a nickname or by their jail identification numbers. So anybody that had any level of knowledge of what her practice was and who her clients were could very easily pick out. And she also made derogatory comments about judges in her posts. She called one judge Judge Clueless. She would refer to the judge as Judge Clueless. And then she would only thinly veil the situation. One of the things that she would say things like, she had a drug addict as a client that was before the judge on some drug charges. Well, the client had said, I'm off drugs before the judge. And in exchange for saying, I'm off drugs and I've completed rehab, the judge gave. Well, so they got that. Then the defendant says to Christine, I can't do 5 days in jail. I'm on methadone. I can't be that away from that for that long. Well, instead of Christine going back to the judge and talking about it, she blogs about it. Something along the lines of, huh? You want me to go back and tell the judge that you lied to him, that you lied to me, that you lied to investigators? I don't think so. So she, on one hand, she's saying, I'm not going to tell them that. That's going to blow your deal. But at the same time, she's telling the world about it. Well, ultimately, she got in some serious trouble. They said, not only is this an ethical violation, but arguably, she's assisting the defendant with committing a fraud upon the court. So that was an issue. Other legal concerns. It might not just be ethical concerns. You could open yourself up, depending on how active you are, to lawsuits. Here's an example out of Texas. A blogging lawyer was sued in Tyler, Texas. Plaintiff was saying, you've been defaming me in this anonymous blog about patents. And so I went to, ultimately, the case settled. Federal judge ruled that it could prove actual malice. But you could see how this type of situation could start and center around this online activity. Disciplinary rules of professional conduct. If you're in a supervisory role, there are rules relating to supervision of attorneys. It might come back to you if your people working under you are using these technologies problematically. There's advertising rules and rules relating to maintaining the integrity of the profession. Here's an example of an attorney, juror. This is a Florida lawyer. He was mad at a Fort Lauderdale judge. And I'll give you a little background here. A lot of lawyers were mad at this judge, but he blogged about it and called her an evil, unfair witch. What this judge liked to do would be to have settings very quickly, matter of days. They'd get the case and say, okay, let's see it in 2 days. The attorneys almost universally felt, you know what, this judge is setting them so quickly that there's no way that we can provide appropriate representation on that timeline. So they would ask for a continuance to push it back, and then the judge would say, well, now you've lost your right to a speedy trial, and things would drag on for years. So they felt like they were put in a bad position, and he called her an evil, unfair witch. Got some hot water about it. ACLU came to his defense, had some compelling First Amendment, you know, free speech arguments, but ultimately he was publicly reprimanded, and he agreed to it, and he was fined by the state bar for criticizing the court. Okay. Again, an example of this is not mumbling under the breath. This is complaining about it online. And this guy got into some hot water. This is the California lawyer, attorney-juror misconduct. This lawyer was serving on a jury, and he, because of his actions, was suspended, lost his bar card for 45 days, lost his job, and paid $14,000 in legal fees. And this is what he did. During this trial, he was posting about his experiences online. This was a felony trial. He was warned not to discuss the case. He was saying, well, you didn't tell me not to blog about it. I wasn't discussing it. I was talking about it. Well, the post identified the judge by name, and he described her. And this guy was a great writer. He was like a frustrated novelist. He described her with some really great imagery. He said something along the lines of, this judge had long, spindly, spider-like fingers, the ones that you would not want snapped at you if you were a child. Pretty great phrase, but, you know, maybe he should have saved it for his first Harry Potter and not his blog about what's going on in trial that day. He also gave the first name of the defendant, described his alleged crimes. He said he was a stout, unhappy man. Not very flattering either. When the lawyer's blogging was discovered, there was a new trial. So everything was lost up to that point because this attorney juror decided to blog about it. These things, I think, are important. These ethics advisory opinions, there's five here that I want you to know about. They all deal with, is it okay for us to have this online presence as judges? In New York, the advisory group was asked, can a judge join Facebook as long as they're complying with all of the ethical rules? And New York said, yes, you can. There's no problem with being on Facebook. You still have to abide by those rules. Please remember the inherent problems of ex parte communications and the impropriety and the appearance of impropriety. So they said yes. Washington State, they were asked, is it okay for a judge to blog? Yes, it's okay. South Carolina, is it okay for judges to be on Facebook? South Carolina said yes, it's okay to be on Facebook. Florida, this is probably the most, a little bit controversial and the most drastic opinion. They said, is it okay for you to be on Facebook as a judge? And they said yes. Is it okay to be friends with lawyers? And they said, no, we don't think that's appropriate. So Florida has said, we don't think it's appropriate for you to be friends with lawyers, specifically ones that would come before you in your court. But then the latest one coming out of Ohio said, is it okay to be on Facebook? Ohio said, yes, it's okay to be on Facebook as a judge. Is it okay to be friends with lawyers that would appear before you? And Ohio said, yes. It's okay to be friends with lawyers, even if they might appear before you in court, because no relationship, online or otherwise, necessarily means there's an ethical problem. You know, if there is a relationship to the extent where you need to recuse yourself, you're disqualified, of course. But just because you have a relationship online does not mean that it's an ethical violation or something that you couldn't hear. So that's pretty broad power. Texas hasn't spoken to this exactly, but nobody has said it's a problem for a judge to be on Facebook. Okay, everybody said that is okay. Other technology challenges for the and traps for the unwary. Jurors using the internet to research and investigate cases. You could Google search this and find case after case where they're told, you know, you'll get the information in trial from the parties. Don't do extra research, but they have questions. Well, how does this drug work, or what does this look like? And they take it upon themselves to look up things, to read things online, to Google it. And part of that is ingrained in us now. We know we're so used to having that instant access to information. We can say, I have a question about that. Let me find the answer right now, and you can find it. Well, that's happening a lot. Jurors and witnesses using technology and social media to communicate during trial or deliberation can be a problem as well. An example where a jury of 12, there was a group of 5 or 6 that had their own clique. So while they're deliberating in a room, you have the general discussion, and then you have this smaller group that's discussing things among themselves. Twittering juror. Be interested to hear what you think about this. In Arkansas, this juror tweeted, I just gave away $12 million of somebody else's money. Okay, and then later he said, that company is probably going to cease to exist because their wallet is $12 million lighter. Do you think there's a problem there? So yes. Well, the defendant learned of the tweets, this company, and they moved for a new trial, and this was their argument. The juror's tweets demonstrate that he was predisposed toward giving a verdict that would impress his audience. Pretty interesting theory there. The judge denied the request. He said that it didn't amount to improper conduct sufficient to warrant a new trial, but you can probably see where a lot of judges would say, that is a problem, let's tee it up again. So there's an example, twittering juror. Internet research. Florida juror in a federal drug trial was using the internet to research the case in violation of instructions. Then when that came to light, they found out that 8 other jurors were doing the exact same thing. So you had 9 jurors doing research. So after 8 weeks of work, the judge had no choice but to declare a mistrial. And then the defense attorneys, in talking to the jurors said, man, you guys were about to win. And he said, we were stunned. It was the first time modern technology struck us in that fashion, and it hit us right over the head. One thing that I want to make you aware of in your book, behind the slides and behind a supplement that cites to articles and cases, some new proposed model jury instructions. I also put them in the recorder. And they were developed by a national group that anticipates the use of the internet and the use of social media and all of that. So I think it would be a good thing to incorporate if you have to admonish jurors before a jury trial. It specifically deals with these types of technologies. So I would use that, tweak it so it works for your court. But that is in there for you to use. Jurors on Facebook. In Maryland, the mayor of Baltimore was convicted for embezzlement, and it was put in jeopardy after they found out five of the jurors that were communicating among themselves. So this was the group that was, during deliberations, communicating to themselves. And a brief filed by the defense of the mayor said these Facebook friends had formed a clique that altered jury dynamics. Okay, I don't think that argument ultimately paid off, but again, it's a good argument, and it could change a conviction. So any questions of people using it and running into problems? But I'm going to leave you scared to use any of these. So we'll go end with some quick strategies. First of all, appreciate what technology can do and utilize the benefits that you can receive from using technology. Secondly, be aware of those misdirection of emails, those programs that guests send it to, and also no control over the subsequent forwarding of your message. All right. If you send me an email this afternoon and you say, "Thank you so much for your class today," and I receive that, I could add on anything that I wanted after that and send it back to your boss and say, "Hey, look what this person emailed to me." I don't think most people would do that. Have control over what happens after you send it. Here's a little clip I think that probably captures how a lot of us have had that second of panic after we send an email.
Oh no. Rod, you sent this email, reply all. You hit reply all. No! You know, I was wrong. You just sent this email to me. Could you imagine?
For drivers who want to get the most out of their cars, it's Bridgestone or nothing.
I saw that on the Super Bowl, and I thought, you know what? That really captures that feeling that you have right after you hit send. You are wondering, did I send that to the right person? Use a disclaimer. If you don't have a disclaimer on your email, here's a sample. And I got this disclaimer right here from the end of an email from Shauna Willing, the executive director of the Commission on Judicial Conduct. For her, it's probably good for you all to use as a judge. And again, it's not that it does a whole lot except put them on notice and shows that you've made an effort to control who gets it. And some people have said, you know, it's also better to put that confidentiality notice up at the top because sometimes they won't read all the way down to the bottom. But there's one that you could use. If you want to blog, blog, and do it to give the public a better understanding of the system. A lot of the canons talk about are very restrictive. Don't do this, don't do this. But we're also told, do go out and speak to the public. Do increase their knowledge of the law and of the courts. There's a sample, Ron Sylvester's daily blog, What the Judge Ate for Breakfast, gives 2-minute video about the courtroom procedure, interviews people that are in the courts, and educates the public. If you're going to blog, give links to other sources that can help the public or other professionals in the field. This guy also links to other source material, makes it everything transparent. More blogging strategies. If you are going to blog, treat blogs like any other form of communication, because those ethical rules still apply, and comply with the Code of Judicial Conduct. Blog on judicial issues. You might give information other judges may need. Those of you that are on the listserv from municipal judges, that Yahoo web group that you can get on through the center, that's a great tool. Anytime you have a question, you throw it out there, 30 responses. Use your knowledge to help others. Give the public a better understanding of the judicial system. Don't write blog posts about or impending cases. If it's going on right now, don't talk about it. even if it's in another court or it's on appeal. And don't mix your personal and your professional life into one blog. Separate those out. If you want to have a personal blog, that's great. Have a personal blog. Keep it separate from your professional blog. You don't want those. You want to have some separation there. It's going to be a lot better. You can also have, you know, multiple Facebook accounts. You might have, you know, a Judge Johnson account, and then you have, you know, Tony Johnson account. And you can control who your friends are and who's connected and the privacy settings that way. That's a possibility. Don't write anything that could compromise your safety or the safety of those in the courthouse. I'm sure that you all are very aware of that, but keep in mind that guy who would like to give his application and schedule online. Not a good idea to put that out there for anybody to see. Don't blog on issues that might cause your impartiality to be questioned, resulting in frequent recusal. You might have a strong feeling about an issue, and then you might put it out there and the world knows about it. Anytime you're going to have to decide about that issue, people are predisposed to get a fair shake. They move for recusal, and you have to recuse yourself. Well, if you have a lot of, you know, extreme opinions out there that people know about, you're going to start seeing a lot of recusal, you know, motions for recusal. And eventually, the city might say, you know what, you've had to recuse yourself out of half of every jury trial that comes to you. I think we need a judge that's going to be able to hear the cases. So be aware of those issues that might cause your impartiality to be questioned. And even online, not even in real life with somebody, and people try to make some connection. Well, aren't you with, you know, Bill? Yes, I'm friends with Bill online. Do you know that Bill is a member of this group? Well, you know, you don't want to have to put yourself in those types of situations to defend yourself. Food for thought, think before you post, even with privacy settings, and there are a lot of privacy settings. Pictures and writings may become public and could come back years later to haunt you. If your post is something you would not want certain people to see, don't post it. Okay? There's different ways to say that. Some people say, if it's not something I wouldn't want my grandma to see, I'm not going to put it on there. And this is we're in a big shift right now about perceptions of privacy. Those of us in this room grew up with probably a fairly strong sense of privacy, and now a younger generation has a completely different. Privacy is out the window. That's why you might say, I don't need to be on Twitter and Facebook. I don't care if somebody just ate a hamburger at this restaurant or is out shopping at Target or whatever. I don't care. Keep that to yourself. But the world is changing. Now it is still controversial if certain pictures would come out online about you all as public officials or national public officials. 20 years from now, people that have grown up with Facebook where their entire life is documented online and there's thousands of pictures, it's not going to be a big deal anymore. People say, isn't this a picture of you smoking and drinking at a party in college? And this looks very, you know, shocking. They'll say, yeah, I've got 10,000 pictures of ones. But we're still in that shift. We still have a large portion of our country that say that have that stronger sense of privacy. Does your online profile reflect the professional image you wish to project to the public, to the legal community, and to the judiciary? Always put this out there, reflect how I want to be seen by my colleagues. And don't let social networking take over your life. Don't let online relationships, don't make those personal relationships that you have, those people that are right in front of your face. I'm going to give you back 10 minutes today. If you don't have any questions, there's my beautiful boys right there. Thank you for your time and helping to make this a great 2011 fiscal year. Please give us ideas about classes that you have. We'll see you next year. Certificates will be mailed to you. You can turn in all of your evaluation forms, CLE forms, throw it all together at the registration desk.